the government even proposing the idea of setting up a sort of island territory like Hong Kong, where they would house brown people who were trying to come to the UK. So this is essentially going to places like the Falklands, Solomon Islands, and saying, can we create an outpost here?
Even when the British handed over on the 9th of October 1962, the Uganda still not yet independent. Uganda will be independent after this, my decision, after I want to see that the whole Kampala street is not full of Indians.
My name is Lucy Fulford. I'm the author of The Exiled, Empire, Immigration and the Ugandan Asian Exodus, which is a book I've recently released exploring, all the topics in that subtitle. So it's a story that's really personal to me because it's my family history. My grandparents and mother, aunt and uncle were some of the exiled. And so, it's a history I've been aware of all my life, but wanted to learn more about. And it's a really underexplored period of history, which takes in the British Empire, post-colonial years, global diasporas and multi-generational identity. And I think that's all the sort of different themes I've tried to weave together in it.
There is no satisfactory answer from this British government.
To truly grasp the depth of Lucy's book, The Exiled, we first need to journey back in time. Before British colonization, South Asians, primarily from coastal regions, had established trade relations along the Swahili coast of East Africa, significantly influencing the coastal culture through exchange of goods. This interaction laid the groundwork for later migrations during the British colonial period in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The colonial administration brought in many South Asians as indentured labourers to East Africa, notably to Uganda and Kenya, for the construction of the Ugandan Railway and other infrastructural projects. Post-construction, some decided to settle, playing pivotal roles in the colonial economy, often as middlemen in trade between the British colonial rulers and African locals, which positioned them uniquely in the economic spectrum. Under the enforced racial hierarchies of colonial rule, South Asians often found themselves sandwiched socially and economically between Europeans and Africans, sometimes leading to tensions with both groups. South Asians were also politically active, contributing to anti-colonial movements and fighting for civil rights, although their relationship with African nationalist movements was occasionally strained.
In the new Africa, one more independent country, the state of Uganda.
The post-independence era saw varying fortunes for South Asians across East African countries. In Kenya and Tanzania, they continued to play substantial roles in the economy amidst evolving political and social dynamics. But in Uganda, they faced expulsion under Idi Amin in 1972.
The president had made up his mind and nobody was allowed to argue. The man who'd personally lowered the British flag during Uganda's independence ceremonies 10 years ago told his erstwhile colonial masters they would have to take back 50,000 of their Asian subjects within 3 months.
The enduring legacy of South Asian involvement in East Africa extends beyond the region, resonating within global diaspora communities, notably in the UK and Canada, which now reflect a meld of South Asian and East African cultural influences. Transitioning from this rich historical backdrop to the intimate narratives within The Exiled, Lucy's book explores not just the macrocosm of events, but also the microcosm of personal experiences. So I had to ask, how did this personal connection to the Ugandan Asian exodus shape her narrative lens and approach in writing The Exiled?
Yeah, definitely. I think what you say about growing up with stories is really interesting because there's definitely a kind of standard narrative that a lot of people will tell me. And it's certainly the kind of idea that I got from my mother of this really idyllic life in Uganda, tropical country, wonderful childhoods. And people will speak of that often. And that's their experience, which is fantastic. But it misses out a huge part of the story. And exploring this meant getting to know the more uncomfortable side of the East African Asian story, which is being complicit in imperial structures and anti-blackness. And, there were things that South Asians benefited from that meant that other people suffered. And I think I really wanted to take a look at all of that. Having that personal link to the story meant I had a reasonable amount of knowledge about it already. Like I said, I'm a journalist, I studied history. So, I kind of knew maybe more than the average person might just sort of with that familial connection. But also, I did want to approach it kind of as academically as I could. So bringing that personal knowledge, but making sure that that was kind of a strength and that added to the story rather than detracted from any kind of deep exploration of it. So yeah, I've obviously got a range of approaches towards storytelling that I've developed in my work more widely, but this is really the first time I've done something so personal. And part of the book is memoir, so I kind of turned the lens completely on myself, and that was really alien for me and quite uncomfortable at first, I have to say.
Before we get into kind of the expulsion itself and obviously, I guess, the more popular side of the narrative in terms of, I think more people are more aware of the expulsion, maybe not in much detail, but obviously because of the impact of the immigration that then came to these shores in Britain, most people are genuinely aware. But just kind of going back just before that, obviously you mentioned earlier about how the Asian experience in East Africa is very different to the African experience in East Africa. Like, could you mind just expanding on that a little bit more and perhaps kind of just shining some light on some of the structures or the ways within which that...
Yeah, definitely. So I think South Asians came to be in Uganda really because of colonialism. That's the sort of root of all of these stories. The British Empire moved people all around it, and part of that was from British India to East Africa. Some came to construct railways, others to work within like the colonial government. Others saw opportunities in Africa because of the sort of expansion there and came independently as traders. There's all sorts of different routes. But what they came into was a colonial hierarchy, you know, and this is essentially a three-tier system, white on top, brown below, and black beneath that. And I think that sort of triangle is the way to view this because it's a very simple way of explaining deep inequality that was enmeshed within this society, within the British protectorate of Uganda. And Uganda gained its independence in the 60s, you know, a good decade before the expulsion. But that inequality kind of was entrenched and it did remain. And I think it's something that Amin used very much as a justification for the expulsion. But it's something that it was real. And I think we need to look at that. I think there's often been a kind of a sense of the expulsion being this kind of mad idea that came from nowhere. But if you look at this inequality, there's a justification really to say, like, why should we continue living where in a country where we are the lowest down? And part of this is sort of, if you think of like quite traditional divide and rule, which is like a way that a lot of people try and maintain control over people. This is kind of what happened in Uganda. And I think the government was quite clear about dividing people up into sections as well as this kind of top-down structure. So Ugandan Asians were very much typified as being the business people and that they controlled the sort of economy. But they'd also been put into that place almost by the British, who kind of kept them away from being farmers initially and put them into kind of middle management. So, yeah, it's also important to say that South Asians participated actively within this. So, yes, that was a system that they kind of came into, but they didn't exactly try and overthrow it. And I think that's also worth saying.
Yeah, no. And I think what I really enjoy, and this is partly why one of the selfish reasons why I wanted to do the podcast with you is because obviously I shared that I have East African back heritage in terms of this time in Kenya, so next door to Uganda, and my grandparents used to own a sawmill there. And from all kind of the descriptions I've ever had of this place, it was quite an elaborate sawmill, and all of the workers were African. And as a child, that wasn't something that I'd never necessarily paid any attention to. But now that I've got older, and obviously you kind of, the pennies dropped and you're like, ooh, interesting, actually. That and now having this conversation, it just fits right into the pattern in terms of the Africans were the workers and the Asians were literally the management. They owned the sawmill and kind of were the management of that. And you're right, the Idi Amin's idea doesn't come out of nowhere. And I think I would definitely be the first to admit that there is a huge South Asian influence in East Africa that is hand in glove. So I think you're right in terms of the British put South Asians in that position, but equally you're right where we do nothing to challenge that, because to be quite frank, we're living very cushy lives and a lot of them don't want to upset that status quo. What kind of leads up then from, obviously there's a 100-year plus of British occupation in East Africa in various forms and ways, and we end up eventually with Uganda and Kenya, etc. I guess what I'm trying to get at is what kind of happens in, say, the decade before Idi Amin decides to kind of expel everyone? Like, what are some of the events that help lead us to what happens in 72?
So a lot of stuff is changing in the 60s. And when you sort of look back at it, you can see the pathway almost to expulsion. And some of that is coming from Britain itself. And that's something I really hadn't realised, the kind of impact both ways. And it comes back to sort of migration policy. So like you mentioned, the Kenya was a key country, which also had a large Indian population living in it. And also with this same inequality. And the government there was starting to push back on this, really. So these policies were known as Africanization, which effectively meant let's give more power to Africans and remove the access, perhaps, that South Asians had had prior to that. And this was happening in Kenya in the 60s, but also Obote, who was the leader in Uganda prior to Idi Amin, was also moving towards this. And this was making people nervous, and it was increasing emigration out of these countries. Then in Britain, people are seeing more people coming, and there was quite a significant amount of people came from Kenya, and it sparked a big fear that there was going to be waves of people coming from former colonies, essentially. The legislation that existed, I mean, I often talk about Ugandan Asians having being British passport holders, and it's a simplification of a very, very complex system of citizenship where people had all kinds of different passports. But effectively, when Britain colonized countries like Uganda, they gave people the option to have a form of British citizenship. When they then gained independence, they became part of the Commonwealth, and citizens of the Commonwealth also had access to come to Britain. And this really was justified because, for example, my grandparents had been recruited directly by a British recruiter in South Asia and in South India even. And they'd come to Uganda because of the British. So to be able to go to Britain because of that was almost a right that I feel they should have had. But politicians in the UK started feeling like this was not something that they wanted to maintain. And it was very much based on race, because this was not something that was being talked about in white majority colonies or former colonies. It was, you know, we don't want too many people of colour coming to the UK. So in the late 60s, there's a series of legislation is passed, the Commonwealth Immigration Act, and these essentially remove the automatic right to come to Britain. Now, how does this all relate to Idi Amin and the expulsion? You might think I've gone off track, but really what I'm talking about here is the fact that these changes that happen in the UK don't go unnoticed in other parts of the world. So Obote in particular sees this and says, well, I mean, Britain is basically stopping people that they brought to this country moving away from this country. So maybe I'm going to have to do something to remove them. And prior to the expulsion that Amin would go on to do, Obote had already started talking about a removal of South Asians from Uganda. So I think when you look at all of these pieces, you realise this is something that has been on the agenda for a while.
Now, obviously, in 1972, Idi Amin expels the South Asian population from Uganda, and it has a kind of knock-on effect in countries kind of next door, but not as much of an impact, obviously, as it does in his own country. Now, how does that kind of happen? Like, as in, like, what are the practical implications of his announcement? I don't know, are there literally police going around making sure that the addresses of South Asians are now empty? Like, how is the decision to kick out the whole South Asian community of the country?
Yeah, so 4th of August 1972, Amin stands up in front of soldiers and says, I've had a dream, very Martin Luther King, I must expel all of the South Asian population. And this has become a kind of myth almost, and retold time and time again that he's sort of dreamed this idea up. But this is the initial announcement, and it's almost reported, and people don't take it seriously because it just sounds crazy. He says the whole population needs to go, and we're talking tens of thousands of people here. The exact number is open to debate, ranges from 50,000 to 80,000, but it's a large number of people. And it's sort of not taken very seriously at first. He then reconfirms it a few days later, and this is when Whitehall starts paying attention, and people within Uganda, it have mixed results. So people I've spoken to, some remember like chaos immediately, like total panic. Others will talk about just a sense that no one could really be serious about removing this many people from a country. So in such a short space of time, because within the week that follows the initial announcement, he starts talking about 90 days. So 3 months in which to leave everything. But yeah, it wasn't really a case of policing it by addresses, because people started to sort of make plans themselves. Once it became clear that Amin wasn't joking and this was actually going to happen, it was a sort of scramble for where you were going to go. Britain wasn't immediately welcoming everybody, and not everybody had British passports. So I think it's important to talk about that. So like a lot of people had taken on Ugandan citizenship, which had been encouraged, a sort of way to show your commitment to the country almost. These had been cancelled effectively, so they were now useless pieces of paper, those passports. So these are the true people that are made stateless by the expulsion order. And there was effectively like huge queues outside different embassies. Some sent delegations who set up like almost like little stalls in the street. And yeah, I've heard these incredible stories about people sort of trying to see which is the shortest line effectively. And it seems amazing to me that your whole future life and that of your children is going to be dictated on which line you decided to queue up on one morning. And yeah, there's amazing stories from different people who sort of had chance encounters with immigration officials or managed to twist people's arms into having sort of spur of the moment interviews to go to different countries. So yeah, Kampala became a city of queues effectively, you know, everybody trying to get their ticket out of there.
I can well imagine. So as we previously said at the beginning, growing up, there's particular stories that I've heard from various members of the family as to how they ended up in England from Kenya in 72. And the whole story only clicked together a couple of months ago when I spoke to my grandma, and finally I figured out that, and again, I guess there's immense privilege in that situation, that at the time, her brother-in-law was already in this country and was a travel agent. And so booked them a one-way flight, got them into the UK, and then essentially went down the refugee asylum seeker avenue. I don't know quite how then that turned out, because unfortunately those members of the family have now passed, and trying to get that information is difficult. But again, just the manner within which they had to kind of jump through the hoops that were just there.
Yeah. People were very entrepreneurial, and I think that's the perfect situation if you have one person in the UK, especially who's able to facilitate your travel, and other people just having someone in the UK that they could say they were going to arrive at their house. You know, it's just that little link that you need to help you with that next step, which is really why when we talk about migration today and people question why people come to the UK, it's generally because they have that. They have one person here that they can rely on in a hostile world.
Yeah, no, completely. Obviously, the expulsion of South Asians from Uganda in 72 by Idi Amin is obviously a massive event in terms of, as you've said, the numbers go from 60 to 50 to 80,000. And a lot of those people came to Britain and obviously went to other countries. Now, considering it's such a big part of, I guess, British history, considering, for argument's sake, places like Leicester would not have the makeup they have today if it wasn't for the events of the 70s and other parts of the country. Like, why do you think it's so overlooked? And what, besides, I guess, your familial connection, made you to want to kind of bring this to the forefront?
Yeah, I mean, aside from my personal interest in it, and yeah, is that thing, is that so many people don't know about it, and people of my generation and certainly below, you know, my whole life I've been explaining this story to people and mostly met with blank faces. And I think it's symptomatic of so many things, which is, you know, the education system is very much weighted towards certain kinds of history. We learn about Henry VIII, we learn about the Nazis, over and over again, but yeah, these kind of things haven't really made it into the curriculum, and when they have, they aren't compulsory, and they're units, you know, I think there's a unit currently in history that is touches on empire, and it's one you can select. Schools could choose to do it, they could choose not to teach it, and it's just not prioritized. And I think more generally, this country is not very comfortable looking at its imperial history, and this very much is a part of that. Fortunately, in the past year, last year was the 50th anniversary of this expulsion. You know, there's been a range of oral history projects that have done a lot of amazing work on these subjects, and they are creating schools packs which are going into the education system. So I'm really hopeful that there will be change in the generations to come. But yeah, it's surprising that so much of these histories have been overlooked in some ways, but in other ways, it's not at all surprising.
Yeah, definitely. Just to throw back to kind of my school experience, you just learn about the Second World War over and over again. GCSE, A-level, even at university, I'm sure we have to learn about it again. And I'm sure we never, ever touched upon empire whatsoever. But perhaps and hopefully things are changing. But yeah, hope. I guess also with books like the ones that you yourself have written, that is always helping to change the kind of the popular narrative, because hopefully more people will read it and hopefully be kind of more up to.
I hope so. And I think, like, Satnam Sangara said that, you know, empire is just so vast, it's quite a difficult thing to get your hands on. And, like, really kind of, when we talk about the First World War, it's like a small block of history that is kind of bookended almost. And the empire is something so large, like, how do you really teach it almost? But what I think I've tried to do with this book is show that it's not something that happened a long time ago. It's very relevant. Like, the British Empire might feel like a long time ago, but this expulsion, which is directly related to it, is only happened 51 years ago. So it's the same generation or one to two out. And that's why we need to discuss it.
No, definitely. Now, obviously, the Ugandan Asians were put in a very difficult situation, and immense resilience portrayed by them in terms of them having to go to unfamiliar territories and recreate a life, which in some respects they would never have imagined, because a lot of the Asians that were kicked out of East Africa were second or third generation by that point have been born there. So it'd almost be, in a sense, like me being kicked out of the UK at this point, or my kids being kicked out of the UK. Now, I guess, coming back to the South Asians from Uganda, like, could you share any particular kind of examples of some of the resilience? Obviously, I'm sure your family falls into that, but anything in particular?
Yeah, I think that's what you say about the different generations. You know, like, a lot of people at the time, and even people have asked this to me now, like, why didn't people go back to India from Uganda? And it's sort of, you know, they were from there originally, so that's clearly where they would go if they were expelled. But, you know, it was multiple generations out. They were living in a sort of very British outpost. They were much closer culturally to Britain in a lot of ways by this point. But that can be, yeah, difficult for some people to understand. And yeah, I think the expulsion wasn't hugely violent for South Asians. There was a huge fear of violence. There was threats of rape. There were robberies. But in terms of loss of life, it wasn't huge. So I think when you think about it in those terms, it can be easy to understate the impact it had on people. But that leaving somewhere that your family has lived for generations and you never expected to, leaving all of your things behind you, is hugely traumatic. And yes, people have told me some incredible stories. One that always sticks with me is a woman called Lata, who was a child in the time of the expulsion. And I write about her family in the book. They were split at a young age. So her and two of her brothers came to the UK. She's, you know, 10, 12. And her parents went to India because people had different citizenship. Not everybody could come to the UK. And in that kind of frenzy, people had to decide what they were going to do for the kind of best life for all of the different members of the family. And they ended up in a refugee camp in the UK as sort of lone children. They were supposed to be met by someone at the airport who never met them. And they kind of ended up in this system that they couldn't communicate with their parents. Probably no one knew this had happened. And they were kind of having to make their own way as, you know, children and young teenagers. And then when they eventually do meet up with their family again, you know, they can't even really communicate. They've become anglicized. They've forgotten their Gujarati. It's like things like this that you don't necessarily think about with something like this. And I think the resettlement camps in the UK, there were 16 here that were set up kind of quickly to process people, were very were very good in a lot of respects. You know, they were a way to give people emergency accommodation, but they were difficult environments for people to come into.
Yeah, I remember doing some research. I can't remember what it was. Someone, I think, had tweeted something about immigration or something or the other, and it was a politician who had given a speech in 1969 or something, and it was on the government website, and it was basically just describing it listed 14 different places that they were keeping South Asians from East Africa in, and most of these were like military barracks in the middle of nowhere. Like, they were very hostile environments. The thing for me is it makes striking comparisons to the modern approach to immigration as well. So now, instead of it being military barracks, they've created a boat to put everyone on. What do you think of the current immigration kind of view of the country? Because although it was hostile even in the 60s and the period that you studied, there was still some give in terms of actually, like, even setting up those camps and processing everyone in a timely manner, so to speak, sounds miles away from the approach that it is today. Like, what's your opinion on things? And I guess, is this almost inevitable, considering kind of the British attitude towards immigration?
Yeah, no, there's huge. I mean, I'm constantly finding comparisons between then and now, and actually Ugandan Asians being housed in sort of former RAF bases is actually not that removed from now, because there's been a recent suggestion that we should use military sites again to house asylum seekers. But yeah, I think the Uganda Resettlement Board was set up to resettle people. So it was about housing them, but also moving them on to permanent accommodation. And this was not a perfect system by any means, but it was an organized system staffed mostly by volunteers who were trying to look after people that had arrived here. And yeah, when you compare that to what happens now, it's not comparable, especially because Ugandan Asians came here with the right to be, most of them had citizenship of some variety, so they could also work straight away. So part of the resettlement board's remit was finding people jobs as well. And one of the major barriers to asylum seekers moving forwards in this country is you're prevented from working. You're not able to have your own housing and you can't make your own money. So how are you supposed to progress? It's a system designed to fail from that outset. And I think when you look at the immigration system here today, it's upsetting that so little has changed over the years, and that, yeah, 50 years after people were coming here from Uganda, we're trying to send people to the neighbouring country, Rwanda. So there's a lot of sort of circular symmetry of some variety with all of it. It's difficult to know what to say about the immigration system today. It's not a positive thing, in my view.
No, I couldn't disagree whatsoever with that. It's just still always interesting to get someone who's done the research's opinion rather than just me kind of shooting from the hip. But going back then to the Ugandan Asians, the expulsion happened. A lot of people obviously turn up in Britain, obviously for various reasons, like you've already kind of gone through. So culturally, there's a lot of similarities, equally passports and kind of just a familiarity, I guess, also with Britain as almost a concept. Now, how do you, and it's kind of funny I'm asking you the question, because you yourself are an example of the result of the Ugandan Asian migration to this country, right? But how do you believe then the arrival and integration of Ugandan Asians in the UK has helped to shape modern multicultural Britain?
Yeah, it's interesting to hear, you know, I'm a product of it, because obviously I know that, but yeah, just to have it sort of stated. I mean, you mentioned Leicester earlier, so it's obviously always a case study for Ugandan Asians because so many people went there, but it shows how this migration was, you know, so pivotal in building multicultural Britain. Leicester was a city that had already had a significant Indian migration in the years before. It was hostile to having more migration, to the point that the city council notoriously took out a full page advert in one of Uganda's newspapers warning people, do not come to Leicester. We don't want anyone else here. The city's full. You will not have a good time. Which more or less backfired because it just put Leicester in people's minds. Yeah. They thought, oh, here's a name of a city. Let's maybe go there. There's obviously some people there. But yeah, Ugandan Asians came to the city. Many had like some distant relative or friend connection and really bought into the fabric of it. They worked in factories. They worked them, set up businesses. They bought condemned houses and turned a lot of that city around. And I think, yeah, like you said, it wouldn't be what it is without it. But it's also somewhere where there are different communities living together and where you don't have to sacrifice any part of your identity. You can be from Leicester and you can be from Uganda. You know, these things can kind of coexist. And I think that is something very special. More widely, you know, there's a lot of work to be done on multiculturalism. I'm not sure we can say it's like a success story across the country, but I think, this was a significant migration of people from East Africa, and it did have an impact. But people had to work really hard to get to have an impact because they faced the racism of the 1970s.
No, definitely. I guess one thing we could definitely state is food would probably be still pretty bland if that.
No, I don't think so. I think food is important, and I've got a whole chapter which I pretty much dedicate to food, which is showing that, because food is so much a part of migrants' stories anywhere. You know, you can't take most things with you, but you can remember recipes, you can find ingredients, and I think food is love, isn't it? And I think it's a big part of migrant stories for a reason, because it's a piece of home that you can take with you, and in the process, people did kind of change the cuisine of this country as well.
And it's tasty, so no one's complaining, right? Oh, no. So in your research, and I have to admit, I didn't get to finish the entire book in time for the podcast, but from what I could gather, your research challenges some kind of, I guess, some people would say they're political narratives. I guess others would say they're perhaps just assumptions that are made about what happened and how it happened. What are you trying to challenge, and what are you hoping that others get from reading your work?
There's a couple of things that I was hoping to sort of point out. One of the central stories that always circulates around Ugandan Asians is this idea of the group as a collective success story, that they were successful people. And when I say success, we're really talking about financial success. In Uganda, who lost everything and then came to a new country, persevered, hard work, and in a sort of very good migrant way, made a lot of money again within a capitalist success sort of setup. And, you know, there's some truth in that. A lot of Ugandan Asians had been traders, business people. They came here and they were very entrepreneurial, and many have gone on to become millionaires, billionaires, and be extremely successful. I'm in no way detracting from that, but it is not the singular narrative of this group of people. There's a whole range of people. As we just said, there were people who were working in factories in Leicester. They certainly weren't making millions at that point in time. And, you know, my grandparents were teachers in Uganda, and they came to the UK and they taught here as well, having moved way down the system from being sort of a headmistress and teaching at university to teaching in primary schools. So experiences are hugely varied. So one of the things I just wanted to do was kind of add to that diversity of the Ugandan Asian story. And, you know, this is a huge group of different people, different castes, different cultures, different religions, and kind of like bring out some of those different flavors. And then the other thing that kind of goes hand in hand with this success story idea is that, which I find really frustrating, because if you are a success, you're saying someone else isn't. And when we're talking about migration, we're saying that this is basically feeding into critiquing other migrants. But kind of almost from the outset in the 70s through to today, this history sort of almost started being rewritten straight away. So these were people who had a right to come to Britain. But almost from the beginning, they start being presented as part of a refugee crisis, and that Britain is opening its arms very generously to a group of people, as opposed to doing what they have to do, essentially. And this has continued and been politicised right up through to politicians such as David Cameron and Boris Johnson, who speak of this very much as a time that Britain stepped up and did a group of people a massive favour. This is just completely historically inaccurate, but also feeds into all kinds of ideas around migration, which is just really challenging. And like for the anniversary last year, Boris Johnson said, the whole country can be proud of the way the UK welcomed people fleeing Idi Amin's Uganda. Okay. Following it up saying, this country is overwhelmingly generous to people fleeing in fear of their lives and will continue to be so. So this really shows how this piece of forced migration is being used as a justification for current immigration policy. And obviously this country is not overwhelmingly generous to people fleeing in fear of their lives, because we're trying to deport people to Rwanda who are fleeing in fear of their lives. So I guess I wanted to connect what happened 50 years ago with the stories that are being told today around migration, and just sort of, yeah, make that clear that some of these things that just get said on aren't really exactly true.
Well, I guess more power to you in that, because more people to challenge this ridiculousness, the better, because it is, it's just mind frustrating, and I'm sure you can relate to it when you're just hearing everyone just kind of read a popular myth, so to speak, and you're like, look, that's not actually what happened. And then equally you just give up, you're like, I can't go around correcting everyone, right?
Yeah, because there's this kind of duality to it, which is, I've said, the resettlement program was welcoming people. It was volunteers and a great deal of kindness. But what happened before that, which everybody likes to miss out, is that Britain tried not to let people into this country. They sent cables around to 50 countries around the world, places like Nepal, Venezuela, like really everywhere, saying, can you also take some of these refugees? And trying to make this into a kind of UN issue as opposed to a legacy of empire issue. And this all culminates in the government even proposing the idea of setting up a sort of island territory like Hong Kong, where they would house brown people who were trying to come to the UK. So this is essentially going to places like the Falklands, Solomon Islands, and saying, can we create an outpost here? And when you know that context, to then hear that like Britain welcomed Ugandan Asians wholeheartedly is a bit of a challenge. Because it's not really exactly what happened.
You mentioned in the previous answer about how, I was just trying to get my train of thought again, I completely lost it. You mentioned in your previous answer about how obviously the experience of Ugandan Asians, or I guess the tendency for some people to kind of have a monolithic view of Ugandan Asians is something that you've tried to challenge in your book, and then hoping to kind of at least get others to kind of be more exposed to. And I guess this also ties into to my next question. I guess part of it is, do you think that's also because there's a there's almost like a weird British fascination almost with class, but in the modern day, it's almost like they want to imagine as though it doesn't exist. And then secondly, obviously we mentioned Ugandan Asians. The majority of them obviously come to the UK or come to Britain because of the various connections, but Ugandan Asians go to other countries as well. So I guess in relation to the first part is the experience of those Ugandan Asians then in the other countries also portrayed in a similar way that the British Ugandan Asians are? Because I couldn't imagine it would be, because Brits have this weird almost, it's the same thing with racism. They like to imagine it doesn't exist, but it's such an integral part of British society in a weird way.
Yeah, so the largest amount of Ugandan Asians did come to Britain. Again, numbers vary. Around 28,000 came through the Uganda Resettlement Board, but more than that would have come, especially because people had come in the previous years before 72 as well, when they started feeling like something was maybe approaching. But also largest numbers went to Canada, India, and then to loads of other countries around the world. There would be, you know, unique experiences in all of them. I've spoken to people who went to lots of different countries, and my family also ended up going to Australia after being in the UK. So I was actually born in Australia. But I think that narrative of sort of success has managed to come through in a lot of places. So when you look at the Canadian case, for example, that is very much a similar story is often told in that framework. So Part of it comes from the community itself. I think it maybe made it sound a little bit like it was an external thing. You know, part of this is the retelling of history from migrants themselves. And it's not just Ugandan Asians who speak in these terms. It's quite common for migrants to want to tell a positive story about their own lives, because, and it's human nature, really. You know, when you've gone through difficult times, you don't always want to focus on that, especially when they've been quite degrading or personally embarrassing. And those are things that obviously come from racism. And you kind of want to say, you know, things were difficult, we picked ourselves up and we're moving on. And that's the kind of arc that you maybe focus on. So I think I'm not surprised that kind of translates elsewhere. But when we talk about other countries, one of the things I hadn't really realized until I did my research was, in terms of my own family's experience going to Australia, like the going in the 70s, this was really just when an extremely racist policy was ending in Australia. So for decades, Australia had a policy known as White Australia, and it's really what it's contained in the name there. You know, my grandparents would have been some of the first migrants of colour to be allowed in to the country, really kind of openly, in the years that followed this. And some of the first people that went to Australia in 72 from Uganda, one of the people I look at in the book, you know, he went to a migrants hostel and they tried to turn them away. They were like, you can't come in here, this is just for white people, you know, because the law had changed, but it hadn't caught up with kind of people on the street hadn't caught on with it yet. So Britain had been changing immigration law to kind of discriminate against people of colour, but other countries had like really quite explicit systems in place already. So this was a time globally when people were moving to other countries and kind of all kinds of shifting sands around race.
In your book, you explore the concept of home and the universality around its meaning. Now, especially in the concept of home, especially in the context of forced migration. Now, how do you, I guess, define home, and how does that evolve as you wrote the book? Because one thing that was really interesting was, I've just come back from holiday and my dad was, I think, like 14 or something when they left Kenya and came to the UK. And he had a Kenyan passport and then eventually became British and had a British passport. So I was asking him, technically our nationality is British. And for someone who has, and I don't know whether, I'm sure you can relate in some way, which is someone who has such a kind of convoluted ancestry, I've never really attached myself to any nationality in particular. Indian, Kenyan, British, I don't technically think or particularly think I belong to any of them. And equally, coming from a slightly more radical family, I'm also like, well, down with all borders, right? Like, why would I associate with national borders? But what was interesting was we went to America, and in America, I realized how British I was in terms of just the interactions with other people. And it was really interesting because when I was asking my dad, I was like, so by nationality, you're British, but how do you feel? And he was like, well, I'm Punjabi. And I was like, yeah, but you were born in East Africa. So how can you feel like, and it was just interesting, the concept of, I guess it's not necessarily home in the same sense, but it's a sense of like belonging to somewhere. So I guess I wonder with the same question, with the idea of home, is how, like, surely that itself is such a convoluted idea. Like, how do you define that, and where is your...
Yeah, no, I think what you say about feeling different things in different places is something I'm really interested in, and I've definitely thought a lot about as I've worked on The Exiled. And this is something that, you know, a lot of people are researching academically, but this idea that you can hold multiple identities at once and that they come out in different strengths at different points in your life or in different circumstances. And I really like that because, yeah, when I'm in certain areas, I might feel more Indian. When I'm in certain places, I'm not going to feel like that at all. And I think if you kind of, for me, leaning into that idea is quite powerful because you don't have to sort of feel one thing or the other or less or more. You can just be what you are in each moment almost. And yeah, I think different people I've spoken to, you know, one girl went to India. She'd never been there before. She was born in Britain. Her mother was born in Uganda. She went to India and immediately felt a like connection. And she's now moving to Uganda. I also felt quite a strong connection when I first went to India for the first time. But I'd never like was several generations out from ever being there. So I think, yeah, I don't think there's any rules around this stuff. I've always said Australia is my home because it's where I was born. I lived the longest. But of course, when I'm there, I don't sound Australian anymore. So everyone there is going to call me a POM. And always have to justify myself a little bit in terms of my identity there. So, yeah, I think I've probably moved towards an idea of home as a feeling more than a physical place. And I think when I was younger, you know, you really just want to belong to one thing. And, you know, this kind of multiple identity stuff is a bit much, but as you get older you can feel like that's quite a nice thing, and having pieces of home in different places to me doesn't feel like a bad thing at all.
No, definitely. One of the last questions that I've got is, obviously The Exiled is a deep dive into a very specific period of history that has huge impact on not just Britain, but kind of the globe overall. Like, are there any other projects that you've got lined up for the future, and kind of what are your plans after this?
Yeah, so I've been sort of, so deep in this project for so long, it's really nice to start thinking about other ideas again. So definitely going to do some journalism work, sort of shorter form again. But all of my work is kind of centered around, underrepresented stories that aren't really in the spotlight. Migration and conflict are huge parts of that. And I'm also quite interested in the like legacy of things. So like I was really looking at the legacy of the expulsion in this book. So also like the legacies of wars and genocides is something I'm working on. And yeah, you mentioned borders earlier, and I think thinking about sort of citizenship and borders with this project has definitely made me want to look into that a little bit more. So I'm probably going to be working on a project around different kind of critical borders around the world and the impact they have on communities in those areas.
What do you believe is the lasting legacy of the Ugandan Asian community in the UK and how they've reshaped British society? Obviously, we've spoken about physically reshaping the country in terms of Leicester, even in terms of food or language. But like, what do you think is kind of the biggest legacy that they've left or are leaving? Because I guess it's still...
Yeah, I suppose it's a living legacy with that idea that, Ugandan Asians are here, a part of Britain, and just contributing like anyone else into this country. But yeah, I think this 28,000 people in itself isn't a huge number, and in fact, similar numbers of other migrants came to the UK in around those years and aren't spoken of in sort of terms of it being a significant migration, which in some ways is a kind of reverse racism. Like we say, we don't talk about this history very much, but then also it's sort of said that a load of people came here because they were visibly different. But over 9 years to 1974, around 100,000 East African Asians as a whole came to the UK, and that is one of the largest post-war migrant groups. So this was significant, and therefore did reshape the country just by having large numbers of people from different cultures here. And I think it's difficult to say what a specific legacy is, but I mean, I think on a personal level, I would say it has been part of making the country as we know it today. Like, Britain is a multicultural place. It has a huge number of different people here, and it is one of the strengths of this country. It's in no way perfect, but when I look at other countries, say in Europe, who haven't had mass migration over the years, they're really struggling with things that happen now when boats arrive on their shores. It's spoken about in radically different terms almost to here. And I think, the Ugandan Asian migration was a part of this turning point when Britain started becoming more multicultural. And I can only hope that things continue to develop positively from there.
Yeah, I hope so too. I just want to say thank you. I got to the end of all the questions that I had planned. I just want to double check, is there anything that you think we haven't included that you want to mention?
One of the things I think that the Ugandan Asian migration did was it kind of started changing attitudes towards brown people in the UK. People came here and were part of labour movements, like fighting for equality, part of things like the Grunwick strike in London, and started showing that like South Asian women weren't just that quiet, retiring type, that people weren't... A lot of the stereotypes that were kind of moving around new people coming to the UK started changing and people pushed back against the racism of the 60s. And I think, South Asians that came from East Africa were part of major movements in the UK during these times. And this is part of the legacy that we have today as well.
And that's the end of another intriguing podcast episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating this podcast. If you're passionate about the work I'm doing and want to support it, consider becoming a paid YouTube member to unlock some cool features or join our Patreon community. You can find the link in the description below. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll hopefully see you in the next video.